You may recognize that distinctive and eerie sound from the Hitchcock movie Spellbound, or from the Beach Boys' hit Good Vibrations. It's music drawn from a theremin. Albert Glinsky, author of Theremin, Ether, Music, and Espionage, knows a lot about the instrument's history.
It was invented by a Russian. His actual Russian name was Lev Sergeyevich Theremin, but the name was originally a French name, so it has the same spelling, T-H-E-R-E-M-I-N, Theremin. And he was caught up in the Russian Revolution. He was born into the Imperial Russia and then grew up and sort of came of age in the Russian Revolution, and one day was told to put on a Red Army uniform, and he was a scientist, a young budding scientist. Next thing he knew, he was a Soviet scientist and kind of taken into the inner sanctum of the Soviets and told, now you will do things for Soviet science. And one day he was in a laboratory when he was still pretty young, and he was working on a device to measure the density of gases, of all things, and found that when he put earphones on and put the circuitry together in a certain configuration, he could actually hear a whistling sound, and he found that when he brought his hand closer or farther away from this device, he could get a higher whistling sound or a lower whistling sound. And the next thing you knew, he decided that he'd build it into a musical instrument. And so the theremin is, I guess, probably the strangest musical instrument you've ever seen when you see it perform, because it's the only instrument you play without touching.
Yeah, I think that's the fascinating thing about it, is it looks like you're conducting this piece of electronic equipment, and it's responding to you as you direct it to do one thing or another.
Exactly. It really has two antennas. One is an upright antenna, kind of like an automobile antenna, and the other is sort of a loop that comes out of the other side. And it's all assembled around this box that has the circuitry on the inside, and the original ones look kind of like writing desks with legs on them. And you move your hands literally through two electromagnetic fields. One of them controls the pitch, and it's essentially just like a siren sound. The closer your hand comes to the upright antenna, the higher the sound, and as you gradually draw it away back towards your body, it's sort of like the siren sound gets lower and lower and lower. And on the left-hand side, if you bring your hand close to the volume loop, it eventually cuts off the sound altogether, and the higher you raise your hand, sort of in an elevator motion going up, the louder the sound becomes. And so playing this instrument is sort of like patting your head and rubbing your belly. It's involving a lot of coordination. So in order to play a melody, you really have to kind of cut off each sound as you make it. Otherwise, you just get a siren in your right hand as you move your hand back and forth through the air. You really have to chop off each note with the left hand a little bit. So it's a very tricky instrument to play.
I was going to say, it is a very difficult thing to do. But in fact, when it first came out, I gather the public looked at it and thought, wow, this is something just about anybody could do.
Well, yes, RCA produced it in the U.S. in 1929, and of course 1929 was, I guess, the worst year you could probably get into any new business, and they thought that they were sort of going to replace the classic parlor piano with the theremin and have every person making their own melodies, and they had all of this very elaborate advertising that said anyone who can wave their hands in the air or whistle a simple tune can now play the theremin. And of course, they sold about 500 of these instruments to the public with that premise that, oh yes, you can just wave your hands like a conductor and now you can make music in your home without any long training. And they said, you know, throw away your violins and forget about years of training. Just sort of be a conductor in front of these antennas and you've got instant music. But unfortunately, people started to learn very quickly that it was just the opposite. And even trained musicians found this instrument to be nearly impossible because you have no point of reference. You have nothing. You have no keyboard, no fretboard, no valves like a trumpet. You don't even have anything like your throat, like just the sensation of sound and voice in the voice box on your vocal cords. You have nothing. You're just fishing around in the air in electromagnetic fields trying to pinpoint notes. So you almost had to have perfect pitch. So it very quickly was relegated to Aunt Rose's attic, you know, and many of these instruments are now collector's items, the older ones, and only the specialized few, the really top musicians, played them.
After Leon Theremin invented this instrument, there was a lot of interest in it. You write in your book that he even gave a demonstration for Lenin, didn't he?
Yes, that was really quite something. Here was this young Soviet scientist who invented this instrument, and the next thing he knew, he heard through various contacts that the great Lenin himself wanted theremin to have audience with him. And so the next thing he knew, he was packing all his equipment into a car and driving off to the Kremlin and waiting in a room for Lenin to arrive. And Lenin walked in very majestically and sort of perused this instrument and sat down. And everybody must have been trembling in their boots, you know, to see Lenin that close up. And he made some remark to the effect of, "What sort of magic do you have prepared for us today?" And you can only imagine young Theremin sort of standing there stiffly and thinking, if I don't perform, I'm really in big trouble. And he not only played his musical instrument, which Lenin was very interested in, but there was sort of a secondary agenda, because the technology that Theremin used for this instrument was also used for a burglar alarm, an invisible burglar alarm that worked on the same principle, where instead of having these two metal rods to create music, you simply had rods that were sometimes even invisible or hidden behind something that would send out electromagnetic fields, and so an unsuspecting person would walk into an area where they were not supposed to be and set off, simply by walking through this invisible electromagnetic field, set off an alarm that could be blocks or even a mile away somewhere and summon the police or the authorities. And of course, the Soviets loved this idea because it had this sort of surreptitious quality to it, a sort of entrapment. And so Lenin was very interested in that too. It was called the radio watchman, because all of this stuff was sort of based on the idea of radio waves and the electromagnetic fields. So Lenin was also thrilled to see that Theremin could do this as well, and immediately had these radio watchman devices installed at the border for the border guards to trap people coming through, and told Trotsky about it. And then he also sent Theremin around on a kind of barnstorming tour all around the Soviet Union at that time to sort of make propaganda for electricity and show the marvels of Soviet science.
You know, with all of this, it's sort of surprising that Theremin then came to the United States to enter into a commercial enterprise to sell the instrument that he made. If he was that important to Lenin, if he had done this barnstorming tour, if he'd been working on burglar alarms, wasn't it kind of odd for him to come to the States?
Well, it's interesting. On the surface, I think that's what the Soviets probably wanted everyone to think, that here was this open-minded young Russian who was willing to share his secrets with the West and bring his technology over so that the Radio Corporation of America could manufacture it. But the hidden agenda, again, was a purely espionage. It was definitely a kind of industrial espionage. And he really was doing a sort of double mission. And his real mission was to collect information on American technology. And he was part of a group of many Soviet engineers at the time who were sent over with the idea that they would do that. It was just that Theremin was a little more visible.
As you write in the book, Leon Theremin got himself into a lot of financial trouble when he was here in America. And he finally reached a point in 1938 when he had to disappear from the U.S. and return to Russia. And he wasn't fully aware of how bad things were back in his homeland. What happened when Theremin returned to Russia?
When he arrived back there, I think he was quite surprised to find a very different Leningrad than the one that he had left. And people either didn't recognize him or didn't want to recognize him. People weren't looking each other in the eye on the street. A lot of old friends had disappeared, and he didn't know what happened to them. He even went back to his old scientific institute and went back to his mentor and expected to get a big bear hug. And instead, he was told, go away and clear yourself with what was essentially at that time the predecessor to the KGB, and come back and then we'll talk. So everybody was very close-mouthed, and he began to realize that this was all of a sudden kind of a totalitarian society. And I think he hadn't really realized that. He left in 1927, 11 years earlier, with a tremendous rush of patriotism, and he came back to a very different world and probably had second thoughts after he landed there about having returned at all. And it wasn't long before he got the middle of the night knock on the door that so many people get or got at that time, and was hauled away to a prison, and then from a prison shortly after that to the worst Eastern Siberian labor camp around at that time, Kalima. He spent virtually almost 30 years in a state where he was veiled by the Soviet Union. He was still a prisoner of the state, and even after he was freed, which was even rare for many people at that time, he was still not allowed to really have an identity, and they wouldn't let him have access to any of his papers or diplomas or anything. So he was really a man without any sort of proof of who he was. He had to do very menial jobs compared with the genius that he was capable of. And finally, what happened was there were a few American contacts that tried to get in touch with him. And through all of that, an American critic from the New York Times, music critic, went over and visited him where he was working in the Moscow Conservatory in 1967 and saw all of his instruments. And it was a sort of deja vu for this person, this writer. And he was very excited. And he wrote this article for the New York Times essentially saying, Theremin is alive and well, and he exists, and I visited him, and here are his latest magical creations. And everyone in the West then, of course, said, well, Theremin is reborn. Isn't this great? Meantime, back at the conservatory director was not pleased at all. I guess there was still a certain amount of paranoia about the idea of a person who had done all that work for the KGB all those years to be actually let out and his identity be revealed again to the West. So his instruments were all smashed up, and he was thrown out of the conservatory at that point and was really back to square one.
Albert Glinsky is the author of Theremin, Ether Music, and Espionage, which recently won the Deems Taylor Award for Music Writing. Leon Theremin eventually came back to the U.S. In 1991, he was honored by Stanford University for his contributions to electronic music. And the filmmaker Stephen M. Martin made a documentary about Theremin. The day after the documentary premiered on the BBC in 1993, Leon Theremin passed away in his sleep. His musical legacy lives on through the work of people like Lydia Kavina, to whom we're listening now. Kavina is the granddaughter of Leon Theremin's first cousin. She was the inventor's last protege.